All right, the first matter set for hearing this morning is State of Nevada, First District Court, Aragon Michael. Ms. McDonald, on behalf of the state, but I guess the first question we have after discussing this, we don't have a written order in this matter. Why should we even entertain this petition?
Mr. McDonald, I hate to pick on you. You used to be a criminal staff attorney for the Supreme Court, so I think you understand the significance of this. And we looked at it as a writ relief, and we're kind of surprised it got through screening because there was no written order. And we set it for oral argument, and we drilled into it further and found that out. So you uniquely used to deal with this issue. But what? How do we consider a writ, as Justice Douglas said, when we don't even have a written order here?
Oh, by the way, welcome to the new Supreme Court.
I did note that you need a written order to entertain a writ of prohibition. So the district court did take an action in making its oral ruling. So I think in making its oral ruling and telegraphing where the district court wants to go, I'm not sure that a written order is...
Well, I can just tell you, we were just talking about it. The only time I think we've ever handled a case on a writ with no written order is if somebody was held in contempt and they're sitting in jail, you know, and we don't, because of the liberty interest, we may jump right in even without the written order. But I think, as you know, and Mr. Drasovich probably knows this from his years of practice, we always send to the district court, do a written order before we proceed.
This has a tortured history. We're aware of some other actions have taken place since that oral finding, but our problem is the specificity of a written order sometimes differs from the oral pronouncement in court. And that's why needing that is very important. We understand the issue before us today is as to honorable versus dishonorable discharge, which begs another question, which is the plea agreement and successfully completing, which is not before us, only this particular portion. But again, our fundamental question is drilling all the way down, and we were at this ninth hour, so to speak, and why should we entertain this writ? Because there's some things that are missing this morning.
And if there's no written order granting him an honorable discharge, then the written order granting him a dishonorable discharge controls.
Well, that may be, I don't know, that may be right, but I mean, it sounds unfair to the respondent. I mean, I guess, yeah.
Well, we understand that statement, but that's not necessarily for this court to weigh in on that. We just know we don't have an order before us, so why would she intervene? And Justice Pickering, please continue.
I want to hear you make your first argument in the new courtroom, so I'm hoping to ask something the subject of it looks like from the minutes of the court that he pleaded to a gross misdemeanor and that was entered and accepted, or am I misunderstanding something on that?
To my understanding, the court said that it would grant the motion to withdraw his plea. Now, whether that new plea was entered, I don't think so.
Okay. So if the motion to grant... If he withdraws his plea to the felony and it's entered as a gross misdemeanor, what is left of his argument that he had a fundamental right and it was impinged, that the felony conviction adversely affected his voting rights and so forth?
When he entered a plea to a felony in 2010, he surrendered those rights.
Right, but if that is withdrawn and he's then adjudicated guilty on a gross misdemeanor, where are we?
Well, I think we're back to this question about whether he successfully completed his probation. Because that's the other question in this writ. There's basically there's the honorable discharge and then there's the successful completion. We argued against the motion to grant the honorable discharge, but there's also the argument that they made below that even with a dishonorable discharge, he successfully completed his probation.
Entitling him to go to a gross misdemeanor.
Correct.
And this, does the status of that impact the status of the first question? This all suggests to me, without written orders, we're really
and to be fair,
walking in sand.
The first issue was the issue that actually has been briefed up, and that is honorable versus dishonorable. The second issue didn't really get briefed up. It's
well, I think because our argument was that if he doesn't get an honorable discharge, then he did not successfully complete his probation and is not entitled to withdraw his plea.
But that's not necessarily the case. He was not terminated or it wasn't revoked. He was cited twice for violations. Stipulations occurred, he admitted to it, but he was reinstated. So at the end of the day, I'll use the term, he completed the probation. The issue is what we're going to call it, and we have two different areas, whether it was successfully completing in one vernacular, and the other is statutorily, which returns certain rights, honorably discharged.
And I think
two are not necessarily synonymous because the secondary or successfully completing is not defined by statute.
But I think you can look to the statute in order to define what successful completion of the probation is, because under 176A851A, it says that you must have successfully completed the entire probationary term.
But that's for honorable discharge. That's special because
it
that reinstates certain rights. It has other things that flow from it.
But if you...
And I don't know, again, because it's not before us, what was contemplated in the negotiations to the term of art used in the plea negotiations, which is successfully complete versus using the term honorably discharged.
And I agree that it could be more artfully pleaded. I thought that when I read over this case. But I do believe that if you get a dishonorable discharge, you have not successfully completed the entire term of your probation. And if you've gone to two revocation hearings, and that is kind of prima facie evidence that you did not successfully complete the entire term of your probation because you were up for two revocation hearings.
But he was not revoked.
That's correct.
Can I ask another question? Because I guess that's a perplexing issue, as Justice Douglas has pointed out. My other question is statutory interpretation, and I'd like to hear Mr. Draskovich on this one. He speaks. Under NRS 176A850, subsection 1, subsection C, are you eligible for honorable discharge of probation when the district court has not made any findings of fact regarding noncompliance with the restitution and there's not any finding of economic hardship? Can you even get it then? And let's see what your thoughts are, and I want to hear from opposing counsel too.
Absolutely not. And okay. The district court found that it had absolute discretion under that provision.
Okay. So,
although Mr. Aragon did not qualify for that provision because there was no restitution. There was no restitution, so there was no finding of economic hardship. So
and he didn't even ask for honorable discharge under that provision, sub C, did he?
Oh, not to my knowledge.
I mean, that was something the district court came up with.
Yeah, reading the record, it looks like the judge took the statute book and was just reading it on the fly and said, this is where I'm going to base my ruling, exactly.
Right. So if there's no basis for it, and I get your point that the subparagraph A talks about the entire period has fulfilled the conditions of probation for the entire period thereof, that having a revocation hearing and being resentenced and all the issues is not fulfilling them for the entire period thereof. Putting to the one side whether or not your plea agreement entitled him, because of the way it was worded, to go back and get a gross. That's a different question. So let's say we credit your position on the statute that the district court didn't have discretion to change this. What would we be ruling on, and I'm kind of going back to the beginning of this, we're being asked to grant extraordinary writ relief against or to interdict a ruling of the district court or to enter a writ of mandamus directing the district court to do something. What do we have before us that it did that justifies us to exercise extraordinary writ relief? You're the proponent of the writ relief, so tell me.
That's correct. I'm here doing that today. His oral ruling is what is before us today. That's what we have. Unfortunately, I think once all of this happened, we kind of intervened, and because
the baton got transferred imperfectly is what you're saying. Yeah.
Argument. My argument today is that the district court did not have jurisdiction to make the ruling that it did. He does not meet any of the provisions under 850 subsection 1 and under subsection 870 that governs dishonorable discharge, there's a mandatory language.
So mechanically, what happens in district court? Let's say that the district, that you hadn't run a writ. What would have happened? He exercised what he believed to be his permissible discretion under subparagraph C of the statute and said, I'm going to grant honorable discharge. Where's the paperwork at that point? What happens next?
I suppose that he would have to draft some kind of order. Why that was not done, I don't know.
Okay. But what about moving it to the state records on whether this gentleman is honorably or dishonorably discharged? How is that related to...
I think part of the reason we're here today is because this is a very kind of odd situation. EMP gives its recommendation, and then the district court says, no, you're wrong, and issues some kind of different order. Mechanically, logistically, I'm not sure how that works, because it should be coming from PNP, and in this case...
It's right.
Mr. McDonald, you're at the three-minute mark, roughly. Do you want to save that time?
Okay, I will. Thank you.
With Justice Kagan. I would submit to parent jurisdiction to impose a sentence. What was not addressed was the discharge papers that were submitted to Judge Scotty in June of 2015. Those discharge papers dishonorably discharging Michael Aragon contained material error. Discharge papers claimed that he had failed to fulfill the conditions of his probation. And that was wrong, and that's why we had that.
Looking through documents this morning in the appendix, he signed off on the mandatory documentation that was provided to him by the state for parole and probation and all the conditions and all this other. And I don't see any reference in the briefing material that tells me either he was or was not noticed of those terms and conditions. I have the general averment, but nothing specifically asked to that.
You are
and
correct.
And then when I read the 2A statutes on honorable and dishonorable, which is kind of before us, I'm not necessarily a fan of the statute, but the statute kind of says what it says and must successfully complete all the terms and conditions. And it doesn't really allow for a hiccup unless you can show us where it would so allow, because he has admitted twice that he did not follow the terms and conditions. It didn't revoke him, but they reinstated him. How are we to treat that reinstatement?
That would be addressed in NRS 176A630, subsection 1. That gives a district court the ability, jurisdiction, and discretion to extend a probationary period, which occurred. And I want to make clear, and it wasn't very clear in the record, and I completely feel this, Your Honor's pain, that we don't have a complete record here. I represented Mr. Aragon, who is present here in the last row. throughout this entire case. In the November 2011 revocation hearing, when you read the briefings, it sounds like both sides, we'd argued for our position reinstatement, the state argued for revocation. No, that case was actually negotiated. It agreed for him to be reinstated, provided he served 30 days flat time. It was our position that they were misinterpreting NRS 176A410 subsection L, the no contact with children. Our position was, well, he had contact with family members and neighbors, but it wasn't a secluded area. Nonetheless, in order to preserve the negotiation, we stipulated to the violation, but then agreed to have him reinstated. Same thing happened March 22nd, 2013. It was again a negotiation where we agreed to have him reinstated. Once again, it was my position as his attorney. I wanted to preserve this drop down that would occur. It's my position that for the state two times in a row to negotiate and to agree to have him reinstated and then come back later and argue for him not to be able to receive the benefit of his.
But counsel, let me ask you the direct question. The reinstatement, whose benefit is that? Is that for his benefit or the state's? The state's position is he could just go to jail. Why is that beneficial to the state, allowing him to continue opposed to just imposing the initial guilty plea?
In both revocation hearings or settings, there is a concern regarding his counseling. And I would submit that if he successfully completes his counseling, which he ultimately did, it's a benefit both to the state because his level of recidivism drops significantly, as is it's a benefit to the defendant because he doesn't go to prison and actually receives the benefits of probation and of counseling. I would submit that there's an overarching, undergirding principle in probation that we want probationers to succeed. We want them to be rehabilitated and then become basically reintegrated into society and become productive members of the community, which Mr. Aragon ultimately did. In reference to the March 22nd, 2013 reinstatement, he agreed to 90 days in custody. We agreed that he would lose all of his good time credit, which means his four-year probationary period became a full five-year probationary period, which he ultimately succeeded. The reason that we had the March 5th, 2016 evidentiary hearing is because the state, not in writing, but to open court, had represented to Judge Scotty that he had failed to complete his sexual offense-specific counseling, which was just, I will take the more kind approach that it was a mere mistake on the part of the state. That's why we had Marshall Lee come in, who testified that he did successfully complete all of his counseling, he passed all of his polygraphs, and he had been a model probationer from the time of his reinstatement in March 2013 up until his discharge in July of 2013.
Okay, so your position is, if I understand it correctly, is he violated, there was basically a deal or a accord and satisfaction in civil terms. There was a deal made, he'd do an additional penalty this 90 days, and you start again and go, and he still had a chance at that stage to get an honorable discharge from probation if he complied with the revised terms.
That is correct.
Okay.
And he spent, actually, it was well over 120 days, it was more closer to 150 days he spent in custody, which I, in my briefs, had referred to as incremental punishment, or proportional punishment. There were violations, but they weren't clear violations in the sense they didn't pick up a new offense, he didn't use drugs. The violations concerned, you know, he hugged a cousin. Whether or not that was in a secluded environment, it wasn't. At one point in time, they felt that he was less than adamant in his counseling, which was addressed after his 120-day stint in custody.
So you're arguing, as a matter of statute, if you're looking at 176A851, which is, sets out the three ways in which an honorable discharge can be granted, your argument is it's 1A, that he fulfilled the conditions of probation for the entire period thereof because those conditions were amended pursuant to agreement by the state?
Exactly.
And in as opposed to subparagraph C, you would agree with your colleague on the other side of the bar here that the economic hardship one and restitution is not a good fit.
It's not a good fit. We're basically trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. But
yeah.
I would submit, and like I said, I have the benefit.
So you are arguing under 1A, so that I can.
I am, although I was present for these hearings, and there were several oral arguments before we had the evidentiary hearing. The judge ultimately made his ruling. His ruling was based more upon his broad discretion as a sentencing judge under NRS 176A100, NRS 176A.
Yeah, he got pretty tied up in 1A of 850. I mean, 1C of 850.
He did.
So then again, this kind of returns to the lack of a written order. What are we being asked to say is an excess of jurisdiction or a failure or an abdication of a mandatory duty?
I'm assuming that does the court want a written order? Like I said, it's a privilege to appear here. I'd be happy to argue this. Like you said, we're kind of arguing under an incomplete record.
Right. Well, I think it would be helpful because Justice Pickering, I think, has limited the issues now, so we know basically what your argument is and what you agree and disagree with Mr. McDonald on. So we just don't know what the judge is doing, and we can't create the rulings here. We have to defer to the district court. So do you think there's any other anything else we can do at this stage, or what's your request that we do as far as this case here?
Well, my request would be deny their extraordinary writ. Outside of that, the court wants more information.
Well, since it's a writ and it's discretionary whether we even take the case, I mean, maybe it'd be better to like deny it without prejudice or something, get a proper order here. And if it were an appeal, we could remand it for further information. But the writ posture is kind of difficult for us to do that.
Mechanically, what implementation has occurred of the district court's oral ruling with respect to your client's honorable discharge?
Granted it in the state, as I recall, and like I said, it's not in the record, and I have to rely upon my memories. Fortunately, in these latter...
I got it, yeah.
I believe that he granted our request. He sentenced him to the gross misdemeanor. Asked for a stay and then filed the writ before.
Okay.
But you still care about honorable versus dishonorable, even if it's a gross misdemeanor or not?
As long as we get to the gross misdemeanor, we're not concerned whether it's an honorable or dishonorable.
That's my understanding. So if the minutes, which suggest that you were granted to the gross after this case was filed in our court, why would you care?
Okay. Thank you.
You have 5 minutes left if you...
No. You don't have to use it. I
hear myself talk, right?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you stand there, we'll keep asking questions. Mr. McDonald.
Want me to start? I think lack of written order is an issue, and I agree... I was thinking about this. If it were an appeal, it'd be there's an easy solution to that in doing a limited remand to the lower court to enter the order. I don't know that there's been an amended JOC for the gross misdemeanor. So that's an issue as well. I think the district court was tied up in the fact that it couldn't, based on the arguments before it, grant relief under 851A. And so it just kind of picked out 851C and decided to just grant relief on that basis.
But your opponent has now conceded that 1C doesn't fit.
Does it? But neither does 1A, because he did not successfully complete the entire term of his probation. Given the evidence that he did, he had revocation hearings, he had contact with minors, he had Facebook,
but we could possibly reach that argument on this oral record, could we? I mean,
yeah, I think, Mr. I agree with Justice Pickering. I mean, we really need a district court to, we're not fact finders in the Supreme Court, so we need the district court to make the factual findings, whether they agree or disagree with you, just make them, and then the issue is squared up for us to look at that stage if the two of you can't resolve the case. And, okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
With that, thank counsel for their arguments this morning as to this issue. And as to writ practice in criminal matters, especially this delicate area, this matter will stand.